Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the shootdown of a Malaysia Airlines Boeing 777 over eastern Ukraine that was apparently downed by a Russian Buk ground-to-air missile fired by pro-Russian separatists under the guidance of Russia's GRU military intelligence handlers who presumably supplied the missiles. The co-chairman of the board of trustees of the Kiev School of Economics, Anders Aslund, a former Swedish diplomat who served in Moscow and Kiev, joins us to discuss the extent to which Vladimir Putin has been playing with fire by arming Russian mercenaries to destabilize Ukraine, subterfuge that blew up in his face just one day after the US and EU imposed stiffer sanctions on him and his cronies for the very covert military escalation that led to the deaths of 295 innocent civilians, including 80 children, en route from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur. Then we will speak with a civilian aviation specialist, John Hansman, professor of aeronautics and astronautics at MIT, where he's director of MIT's International Center for Air Transportation. We will discuss the many air corridors for civilian airliners that routinely fly over territories at war and what warnings are coordinated and issued by international authorities in view of the fact that American carriers were avoiding the region that borders eastern Ukraine and Russia. Yet this daily flight by Malaysia Airlines from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur continued to use this corridor. Then finally, we will examine the other tragedy in the news today, and that is the ground invasion of Gaza by Israel's military following a brief truce for besieged and traumatized civilians to get food and water. Lisa Goldman, the director of the Israel-Palestine Initiative at the New America Foundation, joins us to discuss the apparent symbiosis between Israeli hardliners and Hamas hardliners, neither of whom seem to be bothered by civilian casualties and neither of whom have any apparent vision beyond a reciprocal cycle of tit-for-tat violence and retribution. And joining us now is Anders Aslund, who is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and the co-chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Kiev School of Economics. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine. And he's the author of How Ukraine Became a Market Economy and Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anders Aslund.
Thank you very much.
And Ukraine's new president, Petro Poroshenko, has called the loss of the Malaysian plane on Ukrainian territory near the Russian border as an act of terrorism. Given that the government doesn't control that area, what kind of forensics can we expect at this point? I guess there are some home videos that are indicating what may have happened. But what's your sense about whether or not there'll be any kind of credible investigation?
Well, I'm sure that there will have to be a credible international investigation. Already what we know now makes this look like the Lockerbie bombing. And we remember how much trouble that caused Libya and many billion dollars in compensation and damages in the end. We do know quite a lot because the Ukrainian media are extremely good, and there's excellent websites. In particular, I read Ukrainska Pravda, which is the best news site in Ukraine. And they have put up all the materials you could ask for. In particular, there is now a YouTube recording of that clearly the Ukrainian security services had put up, where the commander of the terrorists in this part of Ukraine is reporting to a Russian military intelligence colonel about having shot down a plane today, and that is half an hour later than the plane was shot down, and he thought then that it was a Ukrainian military transport plane. And previously this week, two transport planes, military planes, have been shot down. One on Monday, a transport plane, and one yesterday, a fighter. And later in the recording, we see an officer come to the plane and finds, to his surprise, reporting to a senior officer that it was a civilian airplane. So it looks as if it was the terrorists who did it, or separatists, if you so want. And they had these Buk ground-to-air missiles. There are also on the Ukrainian website several pictures of his Buk missiles, which look like a truck with four big missiles on them, that they were the vehicle to shoot them down, because this airplane was flying very high up, 10,000 meters up, and the Ukrainian government say that they don't have any missiles that, with which they could shoot down such an airplane, even if they wanted to. And here it is the third airplane this week that is being shot down in the, this area, and we have the recordings. So it looks all very, very likely, and indeed the first people who were there were these separatist soldiers.
So, Anders Aslan, if the separatists have the Buk missile, which is an advanced surface-to-air missile, which would have to have been supplied by Russia, and you've just mentioned the Ukrainians don't have them, so they couldn't have been stolen from Ukrainian inventories. And furthermore, if the rebel commander on the ground is boasting to a Russian colonel, presumably a GRU colonel, then the assumption all along has been that Vladimir Putin is conducting a new form of hybrid warfare, which involves a combination of military force, covert actions, and disinformation, and that largely he has outsourced the Ukrainian, Eastern Ukrainian destabilization to the GRU, and that this looks like a real smoking gun.
It does. So it's really just to check if his YouTube recording that they are correct. If they are correct, and obviously the U.S. intelligence can check that with the Ukrainian intelligence that clearly have put this up.
So presumably, because of what happened with the KL Korean airliner 007 that was shot down back in 1983 by the Soviets, the evidence eventually of the pilot's conversation, the Russian pilot's conversation, came from the National Security Agency. So presumably, there will be some satellite data, do you think, available that would show the signature of a missile, and that way you could find out exactly where it was fired from?
I think so. I think that the U.S. has very good intelligence from this area, and I also presume that this is the reason why we saw such very severe U.S. sanctions against Russia yesterday after a long period of very little sanctions against Russia. I think that the U.S. authorities simply drew the conclusion that Russia has gone too far. This looks more like a military invasion than we are prepared to accept.
Well, that was yesterday, but today it's gotten so much worse, right? I mean, what evidence were there? They were acting on the evidence of the 12,000 extra troops on the border and the shoot-down of the two planes so far. But doesn't this shoot-down of a Malaysian airliner, isn't that a game-changer?
It certainly is, but I mean, I think that the U.S. intelligence knew that the separatists had all this equipment, and that's why they reacted so sharply already yesterday. And my suspicion is simply that these separatists, they have more military hardware than they have intelligence, so they did not know what they were shooting.
Again, I'm speaking with Anders Aslan, who is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and the co-chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Kiev School of Economics. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine, and is the author of How Ukraine Became a Market Economy and Democracy. Now, already the Russian media is reporting And I'm afraid, you know, I'm sure it's no surprise to you how cynical and how flagrant the lies are in the Russian media. But they're reporting that now that the plane that the Ukrainians shot down this airliner, mistaking it for Vladimir Putin's plane flying back from Brazil. So one can't expect a lot of honesty from Russia. But how much do you think is this Putin's Chernobyl moment? Remember when Chernobyl happened, Gorbachev, who was a fresh breath of air, went along with the old Soviet line of denying, denying, denying until it was impossible to deny. And then the same thing, of course, happened with KL007. What kind of transparency do you think we're going to get from Russia?
On Chernobyl, I actually worked as a Swedish diplomat in Moscow at the time, and we at the Swedish embassy were the first to know that Chernobyl had happened, because it was the Swedish seismological authorities that first noticed it. Whomever we talked to in Russia, they hadn't got a clue about it. So it was several very strange days. Well, I think that President Putin has ended up in a very tough place now. And I doubt that he can continue presenting all of this misinformation any longer, because this has gone too far. And think of the Western reaction against Libya after Lockerbie. Of course, it wouldn't be as sharp towards Russia. But, for example, 23 Americans seem to have been killed, four Frenchmen, several Brits, and a large number of Dutchmen. So this involves many Western countries, and they talk about 70 children that have been killed on the plane. It's too early. We get fragments only so far. But this will have big repercussions involving many countries. So President Putin really needs to reconsider his whole policy, I think, because of this.
Well, isn't it a case of Putin's been playing with fire, and he's been carefully calibrating the destabilization just short of provoking an increase in sanctions? And it was only yesterday that the Europeans in Brussels at the EU summit decided to ramp up sanctions, perhaps in response to the White House's ramping up sanctions. So hasn't that been the game that Putin's been playing?
Yeah, and he has really been playing with fire, and now he can't control the fire any longer. That's the impression one gets. And of course, in that situation, you can't sit still. You have either to retreat or to attack, and it's very difficult to see how he really can attack now. So I would rather expect to see some retreat, but he's in a very tight spot. And, of course, if he retreats, the Russian nationalists that have now been pampered for a long time will get very angry indeed.
Well, but at what point does reality intrude on the Russian nationalists and these the surrogates of the GRU operating in eastern Ukraine who are responsible for this monstrous tragedy? Are you suggesting they simply have no shame, that there's no embarrassment, there's no culpability, there's no recognition, at the very least, that they screwed up?
Well, at this level, I don't think that they have any sense of accountability at all. The Russian leaders of separatists in Donetsk, because they are Russian citizens, they are Russian officers, they have been fighting since 1992 in various places, in Transnistria, in Chechnya, and in Bosnia. And now they had got bored, so they wanted to have a new war to fight in. These are really mercenaries and professional soldiers who don't know anything but war.
And that's my understanding of what happened to the GRU in the post-Soviet era, that it sort of merged with all kinds of criminal gangs and mercenaries. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, you can say in broader terms also, in much of the former Soviet Union, we are seeing that the old KGB is really the ruler, and it's a mixture of new power structures, old KGB structures, and organized crime and modern business.
So this is a new hybrid, is it not, in terms of geopolitics, national security, and organized crime, nuclear weapons, and the mafia?
Yeah, I don't think that we should be too worried about the nuclear arms, because they can't really be used in a sensible fashion, fortunately. But all the rest, yes. And this combination of secret police, business and mafia, and rulers of the state, that was really worrisome. And, of course, the best way of sorting this out is transparency, so that we figure out what is really going on, and that the people there, Russians, figure out what's going on In Ukraine, the media are extremely free and quite good quality now. So the Ukrainians understand reasonably well.
Well, but it'll be a heavy lift to get the Russians to understand. Putin is riding high in the polls. I'm just trying to get a sense of whether there's going to be a reaction when eventually the truth filters through to the Russian people of what really happened, whether they'll have buyer's remorse in their adulation of Putin.
I would think and hope so, but if you look up on the opinion polls in Russia so far, there's massive support for Putin and his actions. But of course, this is because people have not realized how flawed the information they receive actually is. And when they understand that, there might be a waking up moment in Russia also.
And will there be a waking up moment for Putin himself? I guess that's the real question. He's dismissed these sanctions that were announced yesterday as being counterproductive and pushing Russia into a corner, and suggested that they're going to hurt the United States more than Russia. But that was yesterday. Today is a whole different new ball game, is it not?
Yeah, well, if you are Putin, you sort of have to say what he said yesterday. If you don't want to say that, I'm a loser, and of course he doesn't want to do that. But I think that these new sanctions yesterday against big banks, big energy companies, and most of the armament companies, that was a real change. And this is about one-tenth of Russia's GDP that was sanctioned yesterday, and very internationally connected parts of the economy. And after this, there can only be more sanctions.
So just to recap, though, what the Ukrainian media are showing now that you mentioned at the beginning, which seems to be the smoking gun, and I haven't seen any of this surface yet on American media, they're showing, it's a YouTube clip of a local commander of this Russian separatist group talking to a Russian colonel, presumably a GRU colonel.
A GRU colonel, indeed.
Who is probably running the operation, which is what is really at the heart of the matter here. And he's saying, you know, he's congratulating himself on having shot down another Ukrainian plane. This would be the third almost in a week. And then later, is the same person realizing their mistake? Is that as well in the same video?
Yes. I put it up now, and now this video has been removed by the user. So now they have taken it away for some reason. And in the same video, an officer goes to the airplane and finds out that it's a civilian airplane, and he's reporting to a senior officer who's after he has heard that it's a civilian airplane. But do they have any arms there? No, they only have toilet paper and cosmetics.
So this presumably was posted by one of the pro-Russian separatists and then removed by him? Is that what you're saying?
No, this was posted in all probability by the Ukrainian security services. They have done this repeatedly.
So why would they take it down?
I don't know.
I see. But it is available. You can't disappear stuff on the internet, right? So the evidence is out there, and presumably more evidence will come in, surely. I mean, it's... Yes.
And we know well that they had these book rockets, and the Ukrainians claim that they don't have them available.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us. It's just a horrible situation to think that people, civilians flying in an aeroplane, are vulnerable to this kind of thing. And you know, the U.S. has apparently warned its aircraft to stay away from this area. My understanding is that the Malaysian plane was flying slightly to the north of its normal route because of bad weather. But there's no indication then that the conspiracy theorists aren't going to come forth and say, well, you know, nobody told the Malaysian plane not to fly there. That's not a possibility, is it?
No, I don't think so. This is a corridor. So they were within the corridor. And I've seen now Air France and Lufthansa and all the other airlines have come out and said that they will not fly in this area any longer. So they have all flown there before.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure as always. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Anders Aslan, who's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and co-chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Kiev School of Economics. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine. And he is the author of How Ukraine Became a Market Economy and Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking to a civil aviation expert on why airliners routinely use corridors to fly over combat zones.
Hey, rejuvenation, the second wind. When will it begin? Repatriation, what is my sin? When will my ship come in?
Me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I believe in on a jet plane. Don't know when I'll be back again. Oh, babe, I hate to go.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Hansman, who is the T. Wilson Professor of Astronautics and Aeronautics at MIT, where he is the director of MIT's International Center for Air Transportation. Dr. Hansman has over 5,800 hours of pilot in command time of airplanes and chairs the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration's Research, Engineering, and Development Advisory Committee, as well as other national and international advisory committees. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Hansman.
Happy to be here.
And this is obviously an extraordinary coincidence and a great tragedy that the Malaysian airliners, another Malaysian airliner, has gone down, this time on the Ukraine-Russian border. It does look as though it was taken down by a surface-to-air missile. Would that be your understanding?
That's what the indications are at this point. There are people have it's consistent with what we have in terms of the evidence where it happened, and then there were missiles in the vicinity of this hostile area.
And why is it, do you think, that this plane was flying in over that hostile area when apparently other aircraft, I think the U.S. aircraft, for example, have been warned not to fly over this area? I believe it was slightly to the north of the normal route, and perhaps there was thunderstorm activities in the south that drove the plane north. But in general, why do you think there isn't a universal or uniform warning against all aircraft to fly, commercial aircraft, flying over war zones?
Well, you know, I mean, there are hostile zones around the world all the time, so there are different standards some people use. The U.S. had alerted that this was an area that U.S. carriers were not supposed to fly over, but different countries have different standards. It may have also been, as you indicated, that the airplane was simply deviating around weather and may not have realized that they were actually in the threat area.
So the idea then that that the Ukrainian government now has said that they're going to conduct an investigation, even though apparently they don't control this area where the plane went down, it's controlled by the pro-Russian rebels. Just a couple of questions. One is there any confidence that there would be any kind of, first of all, would the crash site itself not be tampered with already? I've seen pictures already of Ukrainian kids walking over pieces of the Malaysian airliner plane. You would think if the rebels were responsible, they'd try and sanitize the site. And since the rebels are largely controlled by the Russian GRU, military intelligence, presumably they'd be on the site. And then what confidence would we have that the Ukrainian government, assuming they could get to the site, would be an impartial judge?
Well, those are all reasonable questions. I think that if it was a surface-to-air missile attack, the physical damage will be fairly obvious. So Even if people have been to the site and have manipulated the evidence, I don't think that will, compromise your ability to determine whether it was a surface or a missile attack. In order to determine the type of missile, get some information from the damage, but of course recovering some parts of it, so would be useful. But again, there are a relatively limited number of missiles that can take an airplane out at this altitude. So this was not a shoulder-launched surface-to-air missile. This was in all likelihood, a medium-range missile. There were known to be Russian-designed Buk missiles in the area, but it's my understanding that they may have could have been controlled by the separatists. That they also there were those type of missiles available to the to both the Ukrainian government and the Russian. So I don't think that will tell us a lot.
And is there any way that international investigators can get in there? If the Ukrainian government can't even get in there on its own territory, it leads one to be skeptical about any investigation that's not conducted by impartial authorities.
The problem is by international law, the controlling investigation agency would be the location where the crash occurred. So now this is a disputed territory, so that actually makes the situation more complicated. But the Ukrainian government, who ostensibly, that's ostensibly their territory, would have the right and responsibility to do the investigation. Now, whether they're considered credible or not, is a different issue.
But wouldn't representatives of Boeing, I understand that in these situations where you have airliners go down, that not only is the country where the crash happened involved in the investigation, the country for where the plane is registered, in this case Malaysia, and the country who built the plane, in this case Boeing, would be involved. Is that right?
Well, the lead investigation would be from the country, but it's normal to then invite both the manufacturer to participate in the investigation, and also, it's not unusual to invite the U.S. to participate. But I'm not actually sure that they have legal right to it. It's normally based on an invitation.
Again, I'm speaking with John Hansman, the T. Wilson Professor of Aeronautics and Astronautics at MIT, where he's the director of the MIT's International Center for Air Transportation. He has over 5,800 hours of pilot in-command time of aeroplanes and chairs the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration's Research, Engineering, and Development Advisory Committee, as well as other national and international advisory committees. So, in terms of the black box that usually is after these accidents, that becomes the subject matter, how important is the black box in this case, assuming that it hasn't already been tampered with or confiscated?
It will be. It will obviously be looked at in whatever. Again, if the hypothesis that the attack was due to a surface-to-air missile, then the black box won't provide a lot of useful information because it will basically be normal up until the point of missile impact. You might get some indication as to whether the crew was aware that there was a missile coming after them from the cockpit voice recorder. But again, that's not going to be very much help. The real question here, if it was a surface-to-air missile, is, who launched it and why did they launch it? And it's very unlikely it was that this airplane was intentionally targeted. It's much more likely that the missile was fired probably at some other target or that this airplane was mistaken for a military target. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say already an advisor to the Ukrainian Interior Ministry has told the press that the Malaysian Boeing 777 brought down by a Buk ground-to-air missile. And the video that's available so far, you see the plane impact explosion, but prior to that, there's no sort of trail of smoke or anything. What's your understanding about what missile impact might have involved? Would it I take it these missiles have a 150-pound warhead, and they have a proximity fuse, so they're not necessarily designed to hit the plane, but to blow up near the plane, right?
And that's correct. And these type of missiles normally would track on heat, so they're typically tracking on the engine, and the impact would be in the vicinity of the engine. So the explosion could, for example, damage the engine and wing, causing loss of control. But not necessarily a fire with smoke.
But if the plane was hit at 10,000 meters, what, over 30,000 feet, it would take a while to get from the impact point to hit the ground, right?
Oh, yeah, that's correct. I mean, it's about 5 or 6 miles up, so, you know, it would take, you know, depending on the trajectory, you know, 5 minutes or so for the airplane to get to the ground.
So there have been precedents, of course, before of airliners shut down, and ironically, of course, it was the Soviets that shot down the KL-007. It took a while to get it to. I believe the pilots wrestled with the controls for a while in that case. Is there any evidence that there'd be any communications from the cockpit that, or any international radar that would have been following it or would be able to pick it up? In other words, would we have radar data that would be independent of both Russia and Ukraine?
It's unlikely. I actually don't know. You know, the air traffic control radar in that vicinity was in all likelihood operated by Ukraine or Russia. So I don't think they have an independent air traffic control radar. It's unlikely you had an independent military radar system. So I don't think you'll get anything like that. Again, the flight data recorder and cockpit voice recorder will be definitive if they're found, and in all likelihood they'll be found here. So I think they'll provide the best data about that. Again, that may tell you something about what happened after the impact, but if it was a surface area, you know, the real question and the reason why we do investigations is to understand what caused the problem, so we can fix that in the future. And, you know, if the cause of the problem was being struck by a surface-to-air missile, you know, that would be pretty clear.
Well, of course, in the case of KL-007, the Korean airliner that was shot down by a Soviet fighter pilot back in 1983, the evidence of the chat with the pilot, the Russian fighter pilot, that, I think, was ultimately provided by the National Security Agency.
Sure.
So I'm just wondering whether...
But that was a very different case in the sense that in that case, the crew had made an error and inadvertently strayed over Soviet airspace in a trajectory that was considered threatening by the Soviets. So, and that was an airplane that was intercepted, so there was voice communication. There was probably a more similar accident that occurred in 1998, when the U.S. inadvertently shot down an Iranian Airbus A300, in that case, the U.S. Navy was in the area. There was an airplane that they thought was a threat. They misidentified it. They did not have. There are records, but they didn't correctly check the records that there were civil airplanes en route. So they thought it was a military attack, and they shot it down. So in that case, I do believe there was a challenge on, I don't remember the details of the accident, but I do believe that the U.S. military made a challenge on the international distress frequency, but it wasn't responded to before they fired. I don't know, and again, I'm sure people will check to see whether there was any challenge issued on any of the frequencies, and those would be monitored by, for example, the NSA. So if there was something like that occurred, it will probably come out.
Well, in terms of an investigation, though, John Hansman, it would seem that, again, that with the caveat that at this point, you know, the territory is disputed, the Ukrainians who claim in their press conference, Interior Minister said that the plane was under the control of Ukrainian air traffic controllers. They didn't say that they don't control the territory, but apparently they don't. And so even if you can get credible and independent people to the site, The precedent, I guess, which wasn't so long ago, was when a Polish airliner crashed with almost the entire Polish cabinet aboard, and they were on their way to a memorial at an area where, during World War II, Stalin's MKVD murdered thousands of Polish officers. A very contentious piece of history to begin with, and then on top of that, the plane crashes, and the Poles never were satisfied with the Russian investigation, even though I think it's highly likely that it was pilot error. Is there anything to be learned from that?
I think they're again, you know, sort of quite different cases. I think that the real focus of the investigation here will be, you know, whether there was a missile, right? And again, that should be very clear from the physical evidence, so it should not be. So I think we'll know fairly definitively if it was a missile. Then the real question will be, you know, from where was the missile fired? That's probably identifiable from satellite data. So the missiles do indicate a trajectory, can be tracked by satellites. So there may very well be satellite data that is useful in determining where the missile came from, and that would then give you clues as to who fired it and why.
And in terms of the way that the protocol for U.S. investigations, my understanding is the National Transportation Safety Administration, who have initial jurisdiction, if it's determined that it's not an accident but is in fact a deliberate act, either terrorism or in this case, a military act, then it becomes the jurisdiction of the FBI, does it not?
I think that's correct. If it's determined to be a terrorist act, it goes to the FBI from the National Transportation Safety Board.
Mm-hmm. So just in closing then, John Hansman, obviously it's early now, but it is pretty disturbing. You mentioned earlier that there's lots and lots of war zones and planes fly over war zones all the time. It doesn't sound like that the safety regime is adequate, does it? If you know, the U.S. can issue warnings not to have its planes fly over, and yet other countries decide it's safe to do so. It sounds like there might be the need for more scrutiny over. I mean, I know they fly over, for example, hundreds of planes fly over right over Afghanistan, Pakistan, the area where the Taliban are operating all the time. So is there any discussions on the international arena about, obviously, you know, we may not be able to end these wars, but we can certainly come up with a regime to stop innocent passengers being in harm's way?
Well, you know, that's one of the challenges when you have conflicts, which is innocent people can get impacted. So, yeah, you can identify risk areas. You can have some restrictions, but it's, you know, it's difficult to close all the airspace because, you know, even in these conflict zones, for example, you may be wanting to resupply people with humanitarian assistance, and you may want to overfly the zones for that reason. So I think that the failure, while there may have been some failures in terms of communication of risk, it seems the bigger issue was a failure in somebody's rules of engagement, if indeed was a missile, and that's, you know, the real concern. And again, when weapons, significant weapons like this, get in the hands of people who do not necessarily use good judgment in using them, that can be a problem.
Well, John Hansman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure.
Again, I've been speaking with John Hansman, who is the T. Wilson Professor of Aeronautics and Astronautics at MIT, where he is the director of MIT's International Center for Air Transportation. Dr. Hansman has over 5,800 hours of pilot in command time of airplanes and chairs the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration's Research, Engineering, and Development Advisory Committee, as well as other national and international advisory committees. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about Israel's ground invasion of Gaza. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lisa Goldman, who's the director of the Israel-Palestine Initiative at the New America Foundation. She has lived and worked for over a decade in the Middle East, covering Israel-Palestine and the immediate region, including the 2006 Israel-Lebanon conflict and the 2011 Egyptian uprising. Her analysis of Israel's media's coverage of the 2009 invasion of Gaza received an International Journalism Award for conflict reporting, and her byline has been published in a wide variety of European and North American media outlets. She is the co-founder and contributing editor of 972mag.com, a progressive digital magazine that is based in Tel Aviv, Jaffa. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Goldman.
Thank you very much.
And in my opening that you missed, I made the suggestion that there's an apparent symbiosis between Israeli hardliners and Hamas hardliners, neither of whom seem to be bothered by civilian casualties and neither of whom have any apparent vision beyond a reciprocal cycle of tit-for-tat violence and retribution. What's your reading on this endless agony?
Well, you can certainly make a case to support what you just said. It does seem that neither side has a plan. The Israelis have a problem on many levels. They have a political problem and they have a security problem. The political problem is that Israel has had Gaza under a blockade for 9 years now, and that blockade includes control of Gaza's maritime waters. Meaning fishermen cannot sail more than 4 nautical miles from the coast. And it also includes control of their land borders. So nothing goes in or out of Gaza without Israel's permission. And the economy, of course, is almost non-existent, and they have, I think, 85% of the population living on UNRWA aid. So, but you have the Israelis have, you know, they have absorbed the message that's been propagated by the government for a decade now that the reason for the blockade is to protect Israelis' security, specifically suicide bombers and violent attacks. So for Israelis, there's been a wall around Gaza. They don't have any visual connection with Gazans. The only thing they know about Gazans is that there are a lot of people living there, and they're ruled by an Islamist government that seems to hate Jews, and they shoot. Then they launch rockets once in a while at Israel. So once every 2 years, when the Israeli army says, well, we've got to go in there and get rid of some of the rockets, reduce their power to attack our civilian population centers, there seems to be, I mean, this is the third major military conference. This is the third military operation Israel has launched against Gaza in 5 years. There seems to be a sort of resigned acceptance in Israel, and also a lack of humanization, I think. The people you don't see seem quite less human. So it is a very short-term policy. The Israelis send the army in. They take out the launchers and the rockets, and then they withdraw. And then Hamas and Islamic Jihad rearm for a couple of years, and then lather, rinse, repeat. Hamas, for its part, seems to think that the best policy to stay in power is once in a while to flex its muscles at Israel, cause some very, very limited damage, and win some publicity points. Very short-term plan indeed.
So, in terms of then this being the third military incursion in 4 or 5 years. Is there a difference, though, in as much as the new military government in Cairo is quite hostile to Hamas and to the Muslim Brotherhood from which it came? And I believe they've secured that border, and the tunnels through that border are being closed. There are also tunnels that Hamas uses through its northern border into Israel, through which it can launch attacks, which is apparently one of the reasons for this military operation on the ground. But the main question is, are the Israeli military promising any kind of resolution here? Is this just a punitive strike, or are they telling the Israeli people that this time we're going to solve the problem?
I think, there is sort of a jingoism in public proclamations anytime a government takes its army to war. So perhaps, tacitly or explicitly some generals have said we're going to get rid of Hamas once and for all, and perhaps some people have repeated that, but I don't think anyone genuinely believes that it's possible to get rid of Hamas, and I don't even think that it's that desirable for Israel, and I'm pretty sure the Israeli government and the army both know that. The removal of Hamas would create a power vacuum in Gaza, and you better believe that there are much, much more radical elements who would step in to fill that vacuum, and that would not be to Israel's advantage. So it's really just a sort of mowing the lawn. You go in there, you take care of the rockets, you kill a few people, collateral damage, and then you withdraw. And also, let's be clear about Egypt's role here and the recent history between Gaza and Egypt. Neither the Morsi government nor the Mubarak government were particularly helpful to Gaza. It's true that President al-Sisi is particularly hostile to the Muslim Brotherhood, and it is also true that Hamas is the local Gaza-Palestinian offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. And it's probably true, although we don't have definitive proof of that, that President Sisi is not terribly displeased to see Israel taking some military action against the Muslim Brotherhood-ruled Gaza Strip that's on its border for various reasons. There's been some trouble in the northern Sinai along the Gaza border with militants going back and forth and suicide bombers, and there's no love lost there. But President Mubarak kept the Rafah border crossing closed most of the time. He made it very, very difficult for Palestinians to enter and leave. Most of the time, people needed special connections to get in and out. And even under the Morsi government, yes, it's true that the Rafah crossing was opened more often. People could go back and forth more often. But still, all Palestinians who flew through Cairo airport reported the same humiliating treatment of not being allowed to leave the airport if they had a layover, of being forced to wait in an unsanitary room that had no hygienic amenities for days at a time. Egypt's relationship with Gaza has always been very ambivalent, very ambiguous, even under the Morsi government.
So, Lisa Goldman, again, the director of the Israel-Palestine Initiative of the New America Foundation. She's lived and worked for over a decade in the Middle East, covering Israel, Palestine, and the immediate region, including the 2006 Israel-Lebanon conflict and the 2011 Egyptian uprising. Her analysis of the Israeli media's coverage of the 2009 invasion of Gaza received an International Journalism Award for conflict reporting, and her byline has been published in a wide variety of European and North American media outlets, and she is the co-founder and contributing editor to 972mag.com, a progressive digital magazine that's based in Tel Aviv, Jaffa. So when you say that the Israelis don't want to get rid of Hamas altogether because there's something worse waiting in the wings in terms of a more radical organization, what about the alternative? I mean, the U.S. war under George W. Bush and Condoleezza Rice were not minding the store when they insisted on an election. Prior to that, during the Clinton administration, a great deal of effort was put into trying to get Arafat and the Palestinian Authority to be less corrupt. And clearly, when that election took place, which the Bush administration insisted go ahead, but at the same time, they weren't prepared for the outcome. And of course, you know, you can't blame the people in Gaza for a choice between voting for the Salvation Army or the Mafia. And they chose the former over the latter. But then, because the U.S. was, you know, in shock and then refused to recognize the results. That's a long-winded way to suggest that is there a way, because I cannot believe that the people in Gaza are happy with this Hamas government, that Hamas itself means zeal. They're fanatics. I mean, nobody wants to be ruled by but they're like the people that shoot abortion doctors in this country, you know. So why can't somebody, instead of being more afraid of the Islamic Jihad taking over, what about is there anything such thing as a moderate Palestinian left?
I mean, yes, the answer, short answer is yes. The longer answer is it's complicated, and I didn't mean to sound glib. Look, the Palestinian leaders, there's a huge leadership crisis amongst the Palestinian elite or the Palestinian putative leaders, just as there is an enormous leadership crisis amongst Israel's liberal center-left and left intellectual elite.
What's left of it?
I'm sorry, what's left of it? Yeah. No, I mean, you know, it's the same thing in Palestine. Palestinian moderates were actually quite prominent, you know, in the 70s and 80s, but they've really been decimated. Society has been very radicalized by political events, and Israel's locked up a lot of people. And I think that a lot of people amongst the liberal Palestinian leadership have just given up, really, frankly, and gone to live abroad. They just don't see this, any resolution to the situation. When you have Fatah, which is a very corrupt party, and ruling the West Bank right now, and you have Hamas, which is, as you pointed out, Hamas is deeply unpopular in Gaza. You hear this over and over again. So one friend who spent quite a long time in Gaza quite recently said to me that she thinks, based on just her own observations, that Hamas is actually more unpopular in Gaza than Israel. And she said, but they can't say anything because there is no, you know, these people have Hamas has an iron grip right now on Gaza. They're quite strong there, I think. There are some analysts who think that Hamas is quite weak and isolated. I'm not convinced that's true. I'm not an expert on Hamas. And I don't read Arabic, but based on the information that I've obtained from analysts and from people who are bilingual and who follow these things very closely, it seems to me that Hamas is quite firmly in power in Gaza.
And you don't think that there's any way that the Israeli military, given the enormous asymmetrical power, can do anything in terms of reducing their power or eliminating them?
No, and I don't think they want to. I think what they really want. Look, the political problem is, and it's a political / security problem, that Hamas is regularly, and not only Hamas, but also Islamic Jihad, which is a splinter group in Gaza, a militia that they have a militia that's in southern Gaza, and they have pretty frequent turf wars with Hamas. Sometimes the two coordinate, and sometimes they're fighting with each other, but. The two groups do launch rockets at Israel pretty periodically. Usually, along the border, we hear a lot about Sderot, which is a town right on the border. But there are also quite a lot of smaller, agricultural villages and so forth. We call them moshavim and kibbutzim that are in the Negev. And those get hit pretty regularly. So it's, for a casual observer who doesn't follow the Middle East as intensely, perhaps, as you and I do, it might seem that everything's calm and fine for months at a time. And then all of a sudden, for no discernible reason, Hamas starts shooting masses of rockets and Israel launches an intense military campaign. But that's not actually the case here. What you have is a low-intensity conflict with with rockets being launched out of Gaza toward Israel pretty regularly. It's true, they're homemade rockets. They're poorly aimed. They usually cause little damage and fall harmlessly in open spaces. But they really scare people. You hear a red alert. You have to run for a shelter, etc. And of course, Israel responds, or sometimes just initiates flyovers and targeted assassinations that often kill people who are just bystanders. And in addition to that, Israel controls every single aspect of Gaza's economy, resources, borders. And there's there are drones hovering overhead 24/7. There are tanks on the hills just overlooking Gaza with the turrets pointed at Gaza. So there's this sense that they're really under siege. And this is the situation all the time. And then occasionally there's a little incendiary spark that makes things way more intense for 2 to 3 weeks. And the whole world sort of clutches its throat in horror as the civilian casualties mount and as the Israelis, spend so much time in bomb shelters with their kids. And then it just seems to die down for a year or two and then it starts again.
So
it's a very, very tough circle.
Sure. But is there possibly an even more cynical motive on the part of, and we know that Netanyahu is having problems with his own war cabinet. The hawks in that are way to the right of him, his foreign minister, and Naftali Bennett, who I watched the other day in horror being interviewed by Wolf Blitzer. He's such a hardliner. It's scary.
Yes.
But is Israel keeping Hamas alive because it's simply – their brand is so disgusting that they can always say, well, we can't deal with terrorists. It also splits the Palestinians and makes it pretty difficult to make any kind of two-state deal. I've never understood, and I've tried to talk to a lot of Israeli hardliners, and particularly here in America, their supporters, and nobody's ever told me what a real end game is. What the end of the day, what is it that you want, apart from getting everybody, kicking all the Palestinians out and somehow dumping them on Jordan?
Yeah, well, I'm sure there are some people who fantasize about that. There's no plan, and that's I think why when you ask people that question, what's the plan, what's the end game, their response has become so irascible because they know that there isn't a plan, you know, and I think that, you know, what defines an unsustainable situation, and this is an unsustainable situation, is that it's unsustainable. So that means that ultimately there's got to be some kind of a blow up, but no one really knows what form that will take. And, you know, meanwhile, Israel, they really, you know, the Israeli government and the elite that Benjamin Netanyahu, the right-wing elite and institutions that Benjamin Netanyahu has nurtured over the past 5 years, they really don't seem to know what they want. You know, on the one hand, they say, well, you know, before the reconciliation agreement between Hamas and Fatah that was, I think, 2 months ago or a month and a half ago, so we can't negotiate with Mahmoud Abbas because he doesn't represent all the Palestinians. There's a schism between Hamas and Fatah. And then Hamas and Fatah announced a national reconciliation, and the government said, well, we can't negotiate now because Hamas is a terrorist organization and we can't negotiate with terrorists. And, there's this real lack of logic. And I think observers, you know, it's like, you know, you probably know that Americans, they always ask, well, where's the hope? You know, they need hope. Europeans don't seem to be so interested in a hopeful ending. But Americans also seem to, and most Western observers seem to want to know, you know, what's the plan? What's the end game? And I just have to only repeat that there really isn't one, that these people are just looking at status quo, keeping the status quo. And it's a really distressing, disheartening, ultimately dangerous status quo.
Well, Lisa Goldman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Lisa Goldman, who's the director of the Israel-Palestine Initiative at the New America Foundation. She has lived and worked for over a decade in the Middle East, covering Israel, Palestine, and the immediate region, including the 2006 Israel-Lebanon conflict and the 2011 Egyptian uprising. Her analysis of the Israeli media's coverage of the 2009 invasion of Gaza received an International Journalism Award for conflict reporting, and her byline has been published in a wide variety of European and North American media outlets. She is a co-founder and contributing editor to 972mag.com, a progressive digital magazine that is based in Tel Aviv, Jaffa. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.